The energy transition is a long and winding road, and it needs to be taken step by step. Learn more at SiemensEnergy.com.
This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, I'm Beverly Goodman, Editorial Director of Investing and Asset Management for Barron's. Welcome to Barron's Live, the taxing edition, part two. This is our second week in a row. We've had Garrett on before. Garrett Watson, Senior Policy Analyst for the Tax Foundation, was nice enough to join us again because we got so many questions last week. We wanted to pick up where we left off this week. So we're going to talk a little bit about what Congress is debating, what you need to know now, and some of what's driving these changes. What's sort of like the bigger, you know, tax or economic philosophy behind everything. So welcome back, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
So we have some sign-up questions, but let's just recap quickly. Last week, the major sort of area of concern for a lot of listeners was the capital gains tax. Can you just run us through quickly what the proposal is? And I mean, we know that ties in a bit with the estate tax too. So maybe you can recap it for us.
Right. So right now, the president in his budget and in the American Families Plan proposed two major changes to capital gains worth highlighting. One is under the existing tax law, capital gains that are held for more than 1 year are subject to a lower tax rate when you sell the asset with a capital gain, up to 20%. The president is proposing if you have a capital gain, if you have income over $1 million and you realize a gain in that year, that gain may be subject to ordinary tax rates, even if you held it for longer than 1 year, meaning you could be subject to a top rate in his budget of up to 39.6%, because he's also looking at raising that top ordinary income tax rate from its current rate of 37%. The other big change that would really change the way in which we tax capital gains for the folks subject to it is under the existing law. If you have a capital gain, say in your in a rental home or in some stocks that you own or anywhere else, and you pass away and bequeath that capital gain as an inheritance to a family member or friend, under the existing law, there's a tax benefit known as step up in basis, meaning the basis of your asset that's used to determine the capital gain is adjusted back to fair market value. And the bottom line of that means that you do not owe a capital gains tax when you sell that asset if you inherited it and it had a prior gain for the person who bequeathed it to you. The president is proposing to, instead of allowing for that step up in basis to occur the way it currently does, over a certain amount of gains, 1 million single, 2 million joint, you will have to pay tax on those unrealized gains when you pass away in your estate. So today, it's probably helpful to look at an example in detail on that, just so folks can understand what that might mean. Take an example of someone, of a couple who are married filing jointly, and say they both pass away at the end with $8 million in assets. And say they have no debt for simplicity, so their net wealth is $8 million. And say, you know, half of that is a capital gain, so you have a $4 million capital gain. And say $1 million of that is in their house. That might be a pretty typical situation for folks in that income and wealth range. According to the president's proposal, when that happens, you're just looking at the capital gain here, so that $4 million. This couple married filing jointly would get a $2 million exemption. So their first $2 million in gains will not be subject to any tax when they pass away. The president is also continuing the existing exclusion for residential gains up to $500,000 for joint couples. So in this case, that would be added to that exemption. So effectively, $2.5 million of this $4 million in capital gains would not be subject to tax. What that means is there would be an additional $1.5 million that would be subject to tax at death for those unrealized gains. And at a rate of 39.6%, which would be owed in the year that the estate is filing their tax return, you'd be looking at roughly a tax bill of $594,000 in this case.
So just to be clear, in that example, it is the we're assuming one person inherits the entire estate, and that one person would be responsible for the tax on the $1.5 million that isn't exempt, right? It's not a case that the estate would pay the tax and then the heir or heirs would get their distribution from.
So in the case of how, and I think this gets into the administrative design of how they move on this, but the realization event in the president's proposal would be that moment of death. So under that proposal, it would happen under the estate, where the tax would be paid then, and then we call it step up in basis repeal. It's actually not technically that, because there still is a step up in basis there. It's just after this tax has been levied, right? And then at that point, yeah, you would have the normal distribution to heirs of the residual of what's left after tax. And as you mentioned, of course, there is going to be a potential interaction with the estate tax. Of course, in the example I just mentioned, this couple's estate would not owe any estate tax, because the first $11 million if you're single is exempt, and the first $22 million if you're joint is exempt under current law, roughly. But for the folks who are up in that level of net wealth, they may be in a situation where they owe both tax on unrealized gains and then pay the estate tax. So there can be a situation in which both are owed before the remaining residual is distributed to heirs.
I also think it's an important distinction just in terms of, you know, people, the beneficiary's perspective. You know, it's one thing to inherit money and then owe a huge amount of tax on that. You would have to either sell or find that money to pay the tax, versus, you know, having the estate pay the tax and the heirs get whatever, you know, portion that is, you know, assigned to them in the will. Whereas at that right. point, they don't personally need to worry about paying a big tax bill.
Right. And that's, when it comes to the estate tax, that's the design that we've chosen, where an alternative could be an inheritance tax, which they sound mm-hmm. very similar, but it's exactly this distinction where, if you were taxing inheritances, it would be taxed when an heir receives it at their tax rate individually. Right now, we've chosen to tax estates, which has the trade-off of having to deal with it at the time in which people are trying to settle estates. Mm-hmm. But that is an alternative way that could be done.
So this question came up last week, a couple of questions actually around this. The realization date that you're saying that the tax would be on is like the day of death, right? So even if the stock price falls, you know, 20% or 50%, you know, the next day after the person has died, the tax would still be assessed on the higher figure.
You know, that's a good question. Often when estates, and this is something that comes up when estates are settling up their tax owed, even under current law, where if you do sell an asset later on, say an executor does that and there's a difference there, typically you can go ahead and deduct that difference and account for that change, even if it's under the estate and not when the person was alive. But that will have to be a situation when we get to the legislative text stage of this that has to be addressed either there or in regulatory guidance, because yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of situations like that where folks will need that guidance. Otherwise, they're going to be stuck with a tax bill that doesn't make sense. It's possible that if that situation was consistent with the way that the proposal was written, you could have a loss that could be carried forward somewhere else. But that comes with its own messiness. So mm-hmm. I think those are the kinds of details that would have to be worked out to make this workable, because you are trying to, it's a pretty big difference, a pretty big change in our tax system to go from the general principle of We're going to tax the capital gain when it's realized to trying to approximate the value of various capital gains and tax them even if they're not being sold, both for valuation and for ensuring that folks have the cash on hand, the liquidity to pay this tax, which will require a bunch of work to ensure that's not too burdensome for folks if this moves forward.
Right. And the notion of this being illegal or challenged in the courts is coming up again. I know we addressed this last week, but can you just give us your thoughts on, you know, as we discussed last week, there has been some retroactive effectiveness of taxes on the corporate front. We both think that this is probably the first time it will affect individuals, but what is the likelihood of a successful legal challenge?
Right. So yeah, the president has proposed a retroactive imposition of this tax starting in April of this year. And that's to ensure that that folks don't sell assets ahead of time to lock in a lower rate. And generally speaking, and there's of course always nuance in tax law as there is with law in general, there's more latitude at the federal level for Congress to enact that kind of retroactive change. There of course are always limitations and nuances there, but I think generally speaking, it's within their power to do so, especially if it's in this current tax year. It might be different if they reach back even further. There may be more ambiguity. Often this comes up in the context of state tax where there's retroactive changes. Those are often harder to withstand challenge. But at the federal level, it may have stronger rationale there, given the federal government's power to tax. But the place where I think there will be a lot of legal uncertainty and I'm sure challenges will be in the details of how this is administrated, right? Where there's going to have to be, especially depending on the legislative side, if it's written in a very vague way, the IRS and Treasury are going to be in a tough spot of having to make decisions about how to administer it. Some of those decisions will be more friendly to taxpayers than others. Mm-hmm. And they're of course going to have to balance that with congressional intent. And if they make certain decisions, that could open them up to challenge if it's too burdensome on taxpayers or folks are going to try to argue that it's inconsistent with the way the law is written. And so I think that makes, this stage of trying to figure out these kinds of details really important because it's the details there are going to matter in terms of how much legal challenge we see on the particulars of this. And as we all know, if you follow tax law at all, that is very slow moving. in the courts and just produces more uncertainty for folks who are trying to, follow the law and just know what they're obligated to pay.
Yeah. And so that your take on that would go both for the retroactive nature of it and also just this idea that, I think historically income has only been taxed when realized, when either like your employer gives you a check or you sell the stock or the house or whatever it is. Has the US ever had a tax on, I mean, this gets at what we're going to get to is a wealth tax, right? Has there ever been a tax on just appreciated assets before?
Yeah, there's a couple of interesting things there historically. On the capital gain side, on the trying to tax income accrued to assets that are capital gains, generally speaking, we have been pretty consistent in applying tax when those assets have been sold. There's a strong administrative reason to do that because you can ensure that someone has the ability to pay and you have an exact value to establish the amount of gain and the tax that is owed on that gain. There was an attempt in the 1970s to reform step up and basis specifically, slightly different from the current proposal, which is taxing unrealized gains at death. The alternative proposal in the 70s was to just allow the folks who are inheriting a capital gain to take the old basis. So if your parents had $1 million capital gain in a rental house, you would just take over that $1 million capital gain. You wouldn't owe tax until you sold it, of course, in that reform. That never got off the ground administratively because there were still challenges related to establishing your basis for a house that's been owned for 40 years, say, or other logistical issues. So it actually was repealed around 1980, very quickly after it was passed, which I think portends some of the challenges that we're going to face now for folks who are advocating for this tax change. On the wealth tax side, generally speaking, there have been, of course, at the federal level, the major impediment there has been that a wealth tax has to be in the Constitution, what is known as apportioned across the states, which that's just fancy speak for saying that it has to be divided pro rata by either the population or the amount of wealth in each state. And that would be very hard to do in the U.S. because there's inequality in wealth across different states, right? And so if it was not designed that way, which is pretty unworkable, that would be open to a pretty strong constitutional challenge on that basis. There were, of course, back, and we're talking back in the 19th or the 18th century, taxes on wealth stocks. And that was one way to get at trying to raise revenue in addition to levies on tariffs or on imports and exports through tariffs and things like that. But that, of course, was a pretty small amount of revenue compared to what we're talking about today, and was more in the context of property taxation than the wealth taxes we're talking about now. But those are interesting to look at because they were historically important source of revenue in the early U.S. And, of course, states rely on property taxes today, which are a more limited form of taxing the stock of wealth that folks own.
So that's interesting. I want to get back to your original point there, the apportionment of a wealth tax. That's obviously a common complaint from wealthier people in especially higher tax states that, you know, say the top bracket for an individual is, you know, something like $500,000, and $500,000 in New York, or especially New York City, is certainly not the same as $500,000 in Kansas City. And that, you know, there's something of a unfairness or disparity, both in terms of the income tax brackets and various benefits that are given to people that are based on income, because how much income you have is obviously means something different depending on where you live. But you're saying that to have an actual wealth tax, that apportionment would have to come into play according to the Constitution.
Right. Yep. So this is not a problem for the income tax because of the amendment for the income tax explicitly exempts it from this. And so that's not an issue with that. But if you are moving to taxing wealth at the federal level, it would, under the wording of the Constitution, have to be apportioned. There are some, of course, arguments by advocates of the wealth tax that it could be designed in a way to withstand that kind of scrutiny, that it's consistent with this apportionment clause in the Constitution. But I think it's fair to say, no matter where you land in this debate, there's enough uncertainty about that it would. That's probably one reason why it hasn't gotten more traction by the White House or elsewhere. Is I think the viewpoint is there are other tools that we are on much stronger legal footing. For example, these capital gains changes that they want to try out first. Though I think, based on the discussion, even over the past year or so, 2 years, the wealth tax will still remain an active form of discussion and consideration, especially depending on how these various other tax proposals go, if they are not enacted in the next couple of years.
Yeah, Michelle has just a comment that the tax code should not be this complicated to serve rich people, CPAs and lawyers. So, I mean, the reason it's this complicated is because we're constantly trying to execute public policy through the tax code, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's something we try to emphasize a lot, is that we're trying to do a lot in the tax code. And unfortunately, there are strong trade-offs related to that. The more we build into it, the more complicated it is. And there is... it is easier for folks of means to take advantage of that than others, right? Mm-hmm. And that is a strong point for simplicity in the code. And it's and of course that does require a hard conversation about what we want the tax code to do and what the alternatives might look like if it's not going to be in the tax code. One concrete example that's often used, you know, by folks who are wealthier is the charitable deduction. Is a great example of something that. A lot of folks think makes a lot of sense that we may want to incentivize in policy, incentivizing philanthropy and charitable giving. But at the same time, on the flip side, right, it is a tool that can be used to reduce to reduce tax strategically. It can be used in a way to produce low effective tax rates. And so then we have to talk about, okay, if we're going to reform that, what does that look like? What might that mean for charitable giving in the U.S.? How do we think about those alternatives in the context of the existing tax treatment? And that's just harder to do when you drill down into these particulars, because we're trying to create this balancing act of incentivizing certain behavior while also ensuring that everyone is paying their fair share and there's adequate simplicity and transparency in the tax code.
Right. And similarly, this notion of taxing unrealized gains is, I think, part of, I don't know, it just seems like we're talking about how much wealth the wealthiest people have amassed, how quickly, and, you know, do we want them to be able to pass it on without it ever being taxed? And I mean, this came up, Elizabeth Warren, of course, talked about a wealth tax. It did not go very far, but there's been a lot more talk about it recently. The ProPublica article that came out a couple weeks ago that noted how much, you know, America's billionaires, like Jeff Bezos in particular, how little they were paying in terms of total tax because so much of their wealth was in unrealized gains. So just walk us through this a little bit. Like, how much can tax policy actually get at this sort of notion of equality? And realistically, you know, I know President Biden has said that he will not raise taxes on anyone making less than $400,000. But what does it mean to be dramatically increasing tax rates on people earning more?
Right. So, yeah, I think there's a lot sort of baked into these discussions. And as you mentioned, some of it is a more philosophical or values based discussion about what the tax code should be doing and how we balance these many trade offs. That's the one thing we try to emphasize is often there are no perfect solutions when it comes to these discussions. There are only trade offs. And when it comes to taxing, you know, the wealthy and unrealized gains, I think there's a couple of margins to think about. Right. One is, of course, just more philosophically. And I think you get at this, there is an intuition by folks who are concerned about wealth inequality that particularly for folks who are accruing unrealized gains, that it would make sense to that there should be a contribution to federal revenue when those gains are occurring, even if they have not realized them. And in some cases are even being used productively in a business or elsewhere. And so then you have to weigh, right, the value of contributing to federal revenue to both the administrative challenge of getting at that and, of course, any potential economic effect of potential, for example, disruption of having to sell a lot of your assets to pay a tax, assets that are maybe locked into productively contributing to the economy. And that's a hard balance to strike when you're thinking about changing the tax code in that way. The other, though, I think related thing is there is this perception that that the tax code could be improved for folks who are consuming. There's a good example in the ProPublica piece, right, mm-hmm. Of folks who are wealthier who borrow on their unrealized gains to consume, right, mm-hmm. To buy a jet or a mansion. And I think there is an intuition that in that case, there should be a contribution to federal revenue, right? These assets are being used to consume. And one alternative that might we've introduced that a lot of folks aren't aware of is maybe we could try to tax that consumption in a progressive and direct manner. There are a lot of advantages to doing that administratively and in terms of fairness to ensure that we're taxing folks based on ability to pay. And then on the question of revenue, there has been a trend of, I think, focusing more and more on the top. And some of that may make sense in the context of, you know, if you do think there's an increase in wealth or income inequality. At the same time, it is concerning because it is hard to sustainably fund new federal programs over the long run using a smaller and smaller share of taxpayers. And so to the extent that we want to reform or expand social insurance or social welfare, I think there will have to be a tough conversation at some point about having a broader source of revenue that's sustainable. And if you look at, for example, Northern European countries and others that have more social democratic social insurance systems, they also rely on broad-based taxes, particularly on consumption. And so that is going to have to be probably part of the conversation at some point, even if you don't mind the current deficit trajectory, but merely just want to see new programs be funded sustainably. It's just going to be hard to do that absent a broader source of revenue, even if you are more on the side of taxing the wealthy at a higher rate than they're currently facing.
Yeah, that ties into a comment we're getting from Lee saying that the current administration is trying to serve the part of its constituency that believes the rich are too rich. And Lee points out that, you know, these are the people taking the biggest risks. And this is one of the few places in the world that when that risk pays off, you can enjoy its benefits.
Yeah, that's right. I think there is an important under-discussed point about economic dynamism, and that we don't want to go too far in the other direction in introducing sclerosis or slowing down rates of growth, especially now coming out of COVID, when we really want to encourage that kind of dynamism. And that's where the tax base and design really does matter to ensure that those incentives are kept.
Yeah. So we have just a few minutes left. I'm hoping I can do like a little bit of a lightning round with you. We have a couple of specific questions about what we've been discussing, just to clarify a couple things. So Gio says, on death, will the $250,000 exemption on real estate gains be voided? So just to clarify, it's $250,000 for individuals, $500,000 couples, and that's your primary residence. It's not all real estate. So what happens with that at death?
That's right. So under both the president's proposal and a similar proposal that's been drafted in Congress on the Senate side, that existing capital gains exclusion would remain. So you would still get that full exclusion on top of the $1 million exemption if you're single, $2 million if you're joint. And so that would be effectively an increase in your exemption amount when you're taxed at death. So that will help for some folks if the most of their capital gains is in their primary residence a little bit, to ensure that they can at least keep that existing benefit in the code.
Okay. Neil is asking if the government taxes the unrealized gains at the time of death, is that added to the basis? So if the stock falls later, could you take a loss?
Right. So I think that is what they're trying to get at in the details of the proposals that we've seen so far, is you would have an adjustment if there is a change in the value of the asset after death in the estate process. It would likely have to be done when it's still at the estate, because it'd be harder to it might be possible to pass on a loss to an individual after that. I think there are limitations to doing that as well legally. So it would likely be the case that, and this would be similar, I think, to other times in which if you did sell a capital gain and you incurred a loss after, as an executor of an estate, after someone passed away, you could still adjust for that as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that would have to be clarified explicitly to ensure that folks aren't paying tax effectively on capital gains they never actually...
That never do get realized.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. I think just time for one last question. George is asking if the like-kind exchange provision is in discussion at all. Any changes there? Could you explain quickly what that is, and then we'll talk with her.
Right. Like-kind exchange, also known as 1031, allows you to take real property for business purposes. If you have a capital gain on it and you sell it, if you buy a property of like kind for business purposes, you can take that gain and reinvest it into another property without having to trigger capital gains tax. So you're just deferring that tax later on while swapping property. The president has proposed limiting that for folks who have gains over $500,000. And so if effectively the way I've interpreted it in the proposal language, if you have, say, a $600,000 gain, that you're rolling through a 1031, the first $500,000 you would not pay tax on, but you would have to pay tax on that $100,000 during the year in which you're rolling that property over. So that, of course, will come with its own issues. Like, for example, you could divide up your property to try to avoid it. So they'll have to find, there's administrative complexity there, but that's the short version of what they're trying to propose there.
Garrett, there's nothing we can throw at you that even budges you a bit. You know it all.
Stuff is busy, that's for sure.
Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry, that's all the time we have for today, but thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So we hope you listen to our next episode of Barron's Live Calls tomorrow. MarketWatch personal finance editor Quentin Fortrell and reporter of the Big Move column, Jacob Passy, will have a discussion on the hot real estate market and what that means for home buyers today. Thanks for listening, everyone. Be well and stay safe.
The energy transition is a long and winding road, and it needs to be taken step by step. Learn more at SiemensEnergy.com.